Support for the World's Podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Nearly 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses, with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out. Things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews are all part of running your own business. And these are precisely the kinds of costly hurdles that can take time away from growing your business. That's why LegalZoom created their business legal plan. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Before we start the show, we have some news. Today is the first day of our spring fundraiser. We need 150 listeners like you to make a gift in any amount to help us unlock $30,000 in challenge funds. Visit theworld.org/gift to make your gift. And thanks for your support. Why we grieve for a building. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. There's a reason why the grief caused by yesterday's blaze at Notre Dame Cathedral has spread to people all around the globe, whether they visited Paris or not.
There's a kind of universalism to the cherishing and the feeling for buildings that are cultural monuments.
Also today, Russia wants to create its own isolated domestic internet.
And that's one of the problems, is just how realistic is this?
Plus, a British-Iranian woman is stopped at an airport.
Are you Nazanin Zaghari? One of them asks. Yes, she responds. The man takes her passport. I have a warrant for your arrest, he says. Come with me.
3 years later, she's still in detention, and her family doesn't have many answers. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For so many people around the globe, it felt, still feels, like a punch in the gut, seeing the Cathedral of Notre Dame engulfed in flames. We know that a lot of you felt that way because you've been telling us.
Going into the Notre Dame, I think everyone has this kind of like visceral reaction. And, you know, it's difficult to say why everyone grieves it. I think just, you know, we look at beautiful things. They're important to our culture and it's important to our world.
Grace Hines, one of the listeners who reached out to us since the news broke yesterday. We'll hear more from her and others in just a bit. I have to say, I felt it in my gut, too. Last night, I was texting my sister to see if she could dig up that photo of the gargoyles when we went to Notre Dame with my dad in 1974. Not sure why I wanted to see it. I know I was there. And frankly, all the pictures of Notre Dame that people have been posting online, they got me wondering, why is it that we're mourning a building like it's a person who died?
They're looking for a way to find togetherness, a kind of cultural togetherness, and architecture is singularly good at doing that.
That's Lucia Ale, an associate professor of architecture at Princeton University. I asked her how architecture unifies people.
The function of architecture is to hold people together, so you would think that you would have to have been there to be affected by this event, or that you would have had to be a Catholic worshiper. But in fact, one of the functions of cultural monuments, such as this one, is to be a branding device for the city of Paris and for the nation of France, and indeed for a whole set of traveling persons who like to travel the world and go visit buildings. And they are motivated not by nationalism necessarily, not by religion necessarily, but by a desire to act in unison with everybody else. This is the same desire that motivates people to want to listen to the same music as everybody else. This is the same desire that makes people mourn the loss of a celebrity. There is a kind of universalism to the cherishing and the feeling for buildings that are cultural monuments.
Buildings, we have to say, also stand for permanence. And older buildings like Notre Dame, we assume, are even more permanent, if it's possible to have degrees of permanence. We expect people to die, not these old structures. How significant is this kind of negation of permanence, do you think?
Well, one of the first things to note is that although the building has stood there in some form since the 12th century, in fact, most of the structure that burned, the roof, is a 19th century construction. So I think that the expectation that people will have that buildings last for a very long time is not borne out by the history of architecture. But this being said, one of the most powerful ways that architecture is a mass medium is that it's a witness to many different kinds of lives and many different kinds of histories and many different periods in history. So I think One of the ways you can think about why people are mourning a very, very, very old building is to say that they would like to be seen as part of a larger trend or a larger phenomenon, a larger history, rather than being confined to, let's say, the immediate repercussions of their daily lives, minute by minute, Instagram photo by Instagram photo.
Lucia Ale, what are you feeling today?
About Notre Dame?
Yeah.
I feel that it's going to be a test case for how monument maintenance and preservation in the French state, but also in Western liberal democracies, is going to be dealt with.
What do you mean?
President Macron has said that we will rebuild this and we will rebuild it together. It will be interesting to see what notion of togetherness will be tested in the rebuilding of this monument. The French state has a long history of very codified, very well-rehearsed procedures for rebuilding monuments, and it also has a long history of having public debates about those monuments. I expect that those two traditions will be conjoined again, and that it will not necessarily be reclaimed by all French citizens today.
Lucia Ale is an associate professor of architecture at Princeton, also the author of Designs of Destruction. Really good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Notre Dame has, of course, impacted people way beyond France, like you, our listeners. Why? Well, you told us the artwork, your family stories, and just the centuries the cathedral has been standing.
How they built it, it's just, you know, it's awe-inspiring. They didn't have the tools we have, so how did they do that? My name is Marilyn Cote Miller. When you go inside any great cathedral, but Notre Dame, you know, the most famous of all, there's a sense of awe. You look up and see that amazing ceiling and all the artwork, and it's very quiet.
Our grandfather died in 1983 before any of us were born. I'm Grace Hines, and I'm in Portland, Oregon. We were finally able to go to Paris to kind of connect with him in this spot we know he'd sat in, because this photo was kind of like a big deal at my grandmother's house. It was like on prominent display. We had grown up with it. We're really proud that our grandfather was in World War II, and I think this kind of, you know, represents what he was fighting for, beauty and art and culture.
I'm Sue Reynolds. My mother traveled to Paris decades ago. It's just one of those things that you remember as a child, something so famous as the Notre Dame Cathedral, knowing that she went in there and lit that candle, and then decades later, I was following in her footsteps to do the same, was especially meaningful to me.
So, you know, it's difficult to say why everyone grieves it. I always thought it would stand. Whenever I visit a place, like if I visited the Taj Mahal or the Notre Dame, I think it's going to, you know, it's been there for so long, I think it'll be there for the rest of time.
The first time I went in the 80s, I think visiting Paris triggered my interest in architecture in general. And to know that that is sitting there in partial ruins now, it just makes you sad. I saw the films last night on the news of people standing outside singing hymns. And I thought, I wish I was there.
Thank you, Grace, Sue, and Marilyn, for sharing your stories and your photos. Take a look at Grace's photos of herself and her grandfather, taken decades apart, in front of Notre Dame. That's at theworld.org.
Watching Notre Dame burn brought back the memory of watching the destruction of the Temple of Bel at Palmyra and the burning of the ancient souks in Aleppo.
Amr Al-Azam is a professor of anthropology and Middle East history at Shawnee State University.
Watching the airstrikes on the Crac de Chevalier, one of the world's best preserved crusader fortresses. Seeing anything like that happen anywhere in the world, whether it's in Afghanistan with the Bamiyan Buddhas, whether it's in Paris with the Notre Dame, whether it's in Syria with some of the sites I just mentioned, it's always extremely painful, because you also know not just the impact that has on you as a person, but also the loss to everyone else, because this is part of our world heritage, our world culture.
So those sites you mentioned, I mean, the destruction there was intentional. It was not an accident. And Aleppo, oldest continuously inhabited city in the world, those kind of superlatives, do you feel like people should have been paying attention to the destruction as ISIS was carrying it out?
Definitely. I mean, but different actors were involved in different areas. And as you quite rightly say, this is not accidental. In some cases, it was just part of the conflict zone where, you know, one group or one side takes up positions, the other side attacks them. The cultural heritage site, the monument, whatever it is part of the battlefield. This was certainly the case in Cracked Chevalier. This was certainly the case in the old city of Aleppo. In the case of Palmyra, however, in the case of the Temple of Bel, this was a different form of destruction in that it was an intentional act, part of a propaganda campaign, if you will, by ISIS to demonstrate its ability to act with impunity and the impotence of the international community to respond to any such aggression.
I mean, we are talking buildings, but this is not to detract for one moment, of course, from the countless lives lost in Syria and the enormous sorrow that means for so many people. As for those buildings, is rebuilding possible now, given the conflict that continues?
Rebuilding is always a difficult decision. Where are the ethical lines of allowing damage to become part of the history, part of the story of the actual monument itself, and where do you intervene as a cultural heritage specialist and then attempt to reconstruct it? And this is something that is very carefully considered and weighed by experts. So in the case of, for example, the Temple of Bel, I would argue that no, it should not be rebuilt. It was destroyed, and any effort to attempt to put this together again will not be the same monument. It will be a new monument. It will be a copy of the original monument, but it will not be the original monument. In the case of, say, for example, the old souks in ancient Aleppo, yes, you would think of the function. It's not just the buildings themselves, but the function of the souk as well as a living, breathing, active market where trade and goods were bought and sold and exchanged. And so by rebuilding, all right, you may be replacing the old original buildings, or you may be reconstructing or restoring those old original buildings with new materials, but you're also preserving the tradition, the history, the trade, the business that was part of that site for so many centuries.
Amr, what restoration and rebuilding efforts have you seen in Syria, however small, that give you some hope?
There are some activities that are occurring that do give us hope. For example, one of the iconic statues of the Alat god that was in the garden of the museum in Palmyra, this was one of the statues that was publicly destroyed when ISIS first took over Palmyra. And they videoed its destruction, but they smashed it using sledgehammers. And I know that in 2017, a team of archaeologists and experts were able to recover those pieces and essentially put it back together again and restore it and redisplay it in the Museum of Damascus. Similarly, I know that in the labs of the Ministry of the Department of Antiquities in Damascus, their labs down there have been working tirelessly to try and restore the damaged reliefs, Palmyrene reliefs, that were also kept in storage in the museum in Palmyra. Also in Idlib, we've seen efforts in Marat Noman in the museum there to work with UNESCO to help restore the historic building that houses the mosaics collection from the dead cities by, you know, stabilizing the building and helping prevent the entire museum from collapsing.
So fair to say bad destruction, but it's not being ignored.
Where possible, there is intervention happening, yes.
Amr Al-Azm at Shawnee State University, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Buildings like Notre Dame, like the antiquities in Syria, Amr just mentioned, these things only seem permanent. What doesn't change is the fact that places like Notre Dame are witnesses to history. The cathedral saw Napoleon's coronation. Joan of Arc was beatified there. And music historians will know this one. A composition by Perrotin Legrand, one of several composers who lived and worked on the premises of Notre Dame in the 11th century. Perrotin and his colleagues developed an early type of polyphony called Organum. Such works have been performed many times inside the cathedral. The French government assures us that one day this music will be heard again in Notre Dame. I certainly hope so. Listening to the world. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
Fundamentally, we believe that investing in women is smart development policy, and it's smart business.
That's Ivanka Trump speaking today in Addis Ababa, the Ethiopian capital. It's one stop on her four-day trip to Africa. In Ethiopia, the president's daughter and advisor met with women business owners, and she paid her respects to the victims of last month's Boeing 737 plane crash. But her visit is being overshadowed by things President Trump has said about the region, about the whole continent. The World's Alison Herrera is here to tell us more about what this trip by Ivanka Trump is all about.
Well, Marco, Ivanka is on a four-day trip to promote something called the Women's Global Development and Prosperity Initiative, kind of a mouthful. This was announced just 2 days after President Trump's last State of the Union address. It's a $50 million initiative with the goal of reaching millions of women. The program is designed to help women start their own businesses through training, education, and some financial support. So she's just wrapped up a visit to Ethiopia, where she visited a woman-owned textile factory and a coffee roasting plant. She's now headed to the Ivory Coast for 2 days to tour a cocoa farm and to attend a meeting on economic opportunities for women.
So what was the verdict on that first stop in Ethiopia? What do Ethiopians think about what they saw?
Well, I spoke with a woman named Berhan Taye. She's based in Addis Ababa. She's a gender rights activist, and she's also working on some social justice issues. She says a lot of people here are calling this nepotism. You know, having the daughter of a president come and visit this country, it's something she says happens a lot in her country. And she also says a lot of Ethiopian women are already starting their own businesses. She says these visits never happen on Ethiopian terms.
If you can have trainings, education centers and stuff, that so that women could learn how to be better leaders, if women can learn how to run their businesses, if women could learn how to, you know, whatever they're doing in whatever space that they're in, and if there's that actual concrete support, yes, then we can talk about women's empowerment. But coming here, drinking coffee, talking about your life context, and visiting textile factories doesn't do anything. You can't eat that, you know what I mean?
Allison, is the U.S. going to spend that $50 million? I mean, it actually doesn't sound that much to begin with.
It's not. And it's uncertain where that money is going to go right now, whether the U.S. will use the money for microloans or to provide money for existing businesses.
President Trump himself obviously has a history of making disparaging comments about women and the African continent. Have those remarks come up or even overshadowed Ivanka's trip?
Yes. You know, she sees herself as someone who wants to promote opportunities and entrepreneurship for women. Remember, she had her own clothing line. Actually, she's gotten some heat on this trip for allegations of sweatshop conditions in her now defunct textile factory in China. She's also been criticized by journalists and women's rights activists in Ethiopia for staying silent on the president's immigration policies and his policies about reproductive rights. And, you know, like you just said, some of the disparaging remarks the president has made about African countries.
Yeah, on that point about the president's policies on reproductive rights, you spoke with several people in Ethiopia and elsewhere in Africa about the global gag rule. That's when U.S. dollars for healthcare cannot be directed to administer or even promote abortions. What have you heard?
Well, Marco, I spoke with a woman named Asia Russell. She works for an organization that promotes HIV awareness and reproductive rights in East Africa. She says it's hypocritical for Ivanka to visit Africa and, on the one hand, promote economic empowerment, while at the same time, her father's administration is tightening restrictions on abortion. She says the issues aren't separate. You can't have women's economic empowerment without women feeling like they can make choices about their own bodies.
The World's Alison Herrera speaking with us about Ivanka Trump's four-day visit to Africa to promote women in business. Alison, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
We have an update now on the case of Shamima Begum. You might recall her story. In 2015, she and two other British teenage girls were spotted on a closed-circuit camera going through security at Gatwick Airport on their way to Syria to join ISIS. This past February, Begum resurfaced in a Syrian refugee camp. She asked to be allowed to return to the UK. Britain stripped her of her citizenship instead. Now Begum is fighting back. British authorities have agreed to provide her taxpayer-funded legal aid in her fight to retain her citizenship. My BBC colleague Dominic Casciani says it's all going to come to a head before a judge in London.
She will have lawyers who will go into a semi-secret court, which effectively deals in national security matters. It's a very strange court. It's in the basement of an anonymous office block on the other side of London. I've been there a few times myself. And those lawyers will put effectively the human rights case for her to be allowed to return to the UK to be reunited with her family, but also challenge what they say is the flawed decision-making by the government to deprive her of her nationality. Now, what then happens is the really interesting bit. We all get kicked out because there'll be secret evidence, effectively an intelligence assessment from our intelligence and security agencies.
Meaning the media, right?
Yeah, that's right. The media, the public, we're all forced to leave. The doors are locked. And then at that stage, the secret intelligence assessments, you know, the evidence gathered by our agencies is presented to the judge about why they say, or rather why the Home Secretary says, Shamima Begum should not be allowed back into the country. Now, the twist in that tale is that she herself does not get to see that evidence. She has no idea what the case is against her. So a specially appointed secret barrister who's not allowed to talk to Shamima Begum effectively tries to represent her case.
There are some recent reports that suggest that Shamima Begum has not told the full story of her time with ISIS. Like these new reports suggest, she carried an automatic weapon and was part of the ISIS morality police enforcing dress codes and that kind of thing. What do we know about her role and how might the new reports impact her case?
I think it's very difficult at this stage to know for sure exactly what happened in the 4 years that she was within the territory. So in Shamima Begum's case, we have these allegations that she was helping suicide bombers, that she was carrying weapons, she was involved in the morality police. Where they've come from is not quite clear. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to know for sure. If she has more to say about this, I dare say we're not actually going to hear it until she is perhaps out of those refugee camps, because one of the theories doing the rounds is that the interviews she gave in which she suggested she had no regrets were perhaps not even the whole truth from her perspective, because she was in a precarious situation. And if she'd said that she regretted her time with IS, that may have endangered her. And we've certainly seen that in other cases where terrorism analysts say there are people out there who are desperate to come home realizing they've made a mistake, and they're prepared to come home and pay for that mistake, but they can't quite say so because if they do so, their lives will be in danger.
How eager is the UK to put Begum on trial or in jail? And what would happen to her if she wins the case to reinstate her citizenship?
The UK government will be absolutely delighted if she never, ever gets into the country ever again. They don't want these people back. France has a clear policy at the moment that it's trying to bring back French national children who are in Syria on the basis that those children have, you know, they have a right to be in France, and France has a duty to try and protect them because they are children. The UK's position on this isn't clear, other than it doesn't really want to have people back, which is why people have been deprived of nationality. So I think in many respects, this is going to be the test case, if it ever actually properly gets going, that will really push the government into declaring its hand about what it really wants to see happen.
The BBC's Dominic Casciani, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're with the world. A quick note before we get back to the show. This is the first day of our spring fundraiser here at The World. Listener donations help us meet the cost of sending our reporters all over the globe, from Saudi Arabia to Antarctica to the U.S.-Mexico border. We need the support of 150 listeners like you to help us unlock $30,000 in challenge funds that will help us to be on the ground wherever the next story takes us. Visit theworld.org/gift to make your gift. And thanks for your support. I'm Marco Werman. A book that's been missing for hundreds of years suddenly turns up.
As a scholar of early modern books and a lover of old books, it's really one of the most exciting things I've ever come across.
A long-lost manuscript and what it has to do with the illegitimate son of Christopher Columbus. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This month, a British-Iranian family is marking a grim anniversary, 3 years since their loved one was arrested and imprisoned in Iran. Nazanin Zahari Radcliffe was detained while on a trip to visit friends and family in Iran. Her family in the UK insists she is innocent and is being held as a bargaining chip. And as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, the Iranian government has done that in the past.
There is video footage of the moment Nazanin Zaghari Radcliffe was arrested. Iranian state media made it public. It shows Nazanin at the airport, about to board a flight back to the UK. She's in a long, dark jacket. A white scarf covers her hair. She's pushing a cart stacked with suitcases. Suddenly, a group of men approach her. "Are you Nazanin Zaghari?" one of them asks. "Yes," she responds. The man takes her passport. "I have a warrant for your arrest," he says. "Come with me." Nazanin looks terrified, confused. 3 years have passed since that moment. Three difficult years, says Nazanin's husband, Richard Radcliffe.
"You know, for a long time we thought it was a mistake. At the beginning, I'd kind of been able to go to work. Okay, I've been distracted. And then when, you know, we went public, I started to speak with other families. And then that's when I suddenly wasn't able to sleep at night, was just having all sorts of nightmares."
Radcliffe doesn't know why his wife was targeted. He says at the time she was working for Thomson Reuters Foundation, a charity wing of the news network. Iran, though, charged her with several crimes, including plotting to overthrow the government. In 2016, she was sentenced to 5 years in prison. She has appealed twice, failed both times. Radcliffe thinks his wife, a dual British-Iranian citizen, is being held as a bargaining chip.
"The judge in charge of parole told her, 'Listen, your case is completely made up.'"
For Hadi Qaemi, a human rights expert, this is a familiar scenario.
"Iran tends to arrest dual nationals for a variety of reasons, and among them we have had cases where the purpose is to use them as pawns, literally hostages, for political, financial bargaining tools."
Nazanin may have been taken because of something that happened before she was born. In 1976, the Shah of Iran placed an order for 1,500 Chieftain tanks from the UK. Bad timing.
"Autumn 1978. Anti-Shah demonstrations had grown to such proportions that the Shah declared martial law in most of Iran's cities."
A year later, there was a revolution. The Shah was toppled. The British never delivered the tanks or returned the money. The same thing happened with weapons orders involving U.S. companies. The Americans froze Iranian assets and didn't deliver anything.
"And that's how you ended up with these sort of pots of cash that are Iranian money sitting in foreign countries' bank accounts."
Then, in 2015, Iran and the U.S. signed a historic nuclear deal. Author Laura Secor was researching the arrests of dual nationals around that time, and she noticed a spike in the number of Iranian Americans detained in Iran.
"Really, starting around the time that U.S. sanctions ramped up and it was clear that we were moving towards some kind of a negotiation, that U.S. prisoners, at least, and possibly British prisoners as well, start to be seen as leverage in a possible negotiation."
Among the prisoners, a Christian pastor, a former U.S. Marine, and Jason Rezaian, a Washington Post journalist. Hadi Qaemi of Center for Human Rights in Iran says as nuclear negotiations took shape, a plan for a prisoner swap began to emerge.
"These negotiations were concluded pretty much at the same time that the nuclear deal was signed. And actually, on the day that the nuclear deal came into effect, on the very same day, a plane left for Iran carrying hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. And the same plane brought out Jason Rezaian and several other Iranian-American prisoners."
Iran released 5 prisoners. The U.S. released 7 Iranians. It also returned $400 million of Iran's cash.
"When ever the Iranian government is rewarded, it really worries me.
Mazyar Bahari is an Iranian-Canadian journalist who spent 4 months in Iran's Evin prison. He says the U.S. prisoner swap might have reinforced the idea for Iran that it could use dual nationals to get its assets back. And it seems like it has been trying to do that ever since.
It's like a father that is brutalizing its own child.
Bahari says, as far as he knows, his release wasn't part of any deal between the Canadian and Iranian governments. He's been following Nazanin Radcliffe's case closely and sympathizes with her family.
Because, you know, when you are a prisoner, you know where you are, you know how you are. The situation is more clear for you as a prisoner, but they are dealing with unknowns.
That's what Richard Radcliffe has been dealing with, unknowns. He's been campaigning nonstop for his wife's release. On the first anniversary of her arrest, Nazanin's family asked supporters a simple question. If they only had 1 day of freedom, what would they do?
People would say things like go to the beach or go to a forest or have an ice cream or, you know, something nice.
They put the same question to Nazanin and her fellow prisoners.
The prisoners, almost without exception, said, if I had 1 day of freedom, I would just want to watch my children asleep.
Nazanin shared multiple wishes. Among them was one addressed to her husband. I would love to marry you again, she wrote. The best thing that could ever happen to me. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
It's being called the Internet Isolation Law. Russia's parliament, the Duma, approved a plan that creates a domestic internet. The plan creates a separate internet to control connections between Russians and the rest of the entire world. Supporters say it's necessary in order to protect their people from outside cyber threats. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. So how's this whole internet isolation plan supposed to work, Charles?
Well, the idea is that they'd have essentially choke points on the internet, a kill switch that they could then shut down in the case of a cyber attack, or more importantly, parts of Russia, regions of Russia, from the wider global internet when need be.
We've drawn comparisons before between this Russian plan and China's Great Firewall, but Russia's a country that's more integrated than China. Is it possible to disconnect a country like Russia from the net? I mean, aren't we talking about putting the genie back in the bottle?
It is a different situation, and that's one of the problems, and certainly part of the debate around this bill is just how realistic is this? As opposed to China, which has just 3 or 4 points essentially where information comes into the country and is quite easy to control, Russia has a whole developed essentially digital industry that's been put in place over the last 20 years. Now, there have been also attempts by the government to interfere and block, for example, messaging services like Telegram. Telegram still works today. And then even other people point out just the cost of all this. I mean, even if theoretically you could do it, it's expensive. It's harmful to Russia's own state business enterprises. You know, the idea that you can be a global company and be cut off from the internet seems a little absurd. The supporters of the bill say this is necessary. This is just something that makes sense.
And for Russian citizens who want free range on the internet, I mean, how's the government going to deal with VPNs, virtual personal networks, that people in Iran and China already rely on to get around these blockages?
Right. It's all whack-a-mole, right? You can try and sort of choke these different points, but people seem to kind of innovate out of it, whether it's VPNs today or something else tomorrow.
So just practically, if I'm in Russia and this law is passed and there is internet isolation in effect, if I go onto Google in Russia, what would I see? Anything different?
Well, I mean, I can say right now, you know, there are certainly websites that are blacklisted right now that I don't have access to, or I have to use a VPN to get access to. That's been in place for some time now. I think one of the real concerns is that even if you do have this law and they do start putting these choke points in place, it's going to slow the internet speeds around the country. So it may not be so much an issue of getting access to some Google document or some web page, but more about the lower internet speeds countrywide.
And if there is like some cyber attack, the idea is that these choke points would automatically kind of just constrict and information data couldn't get in or out of the country.
So that's right. So critics of the bill will say this is really about control, that this is the government coming in trying to control the flow of information within the country. And over the last several months, there's been a series of protests down in southern Russia and in Ingushetia, where they've essentially isolated these protests, cut off the internet completely, cut off all mobile phone providers' access to the internet, and essentially isolated the idea of what's happening there from spreading to other regions. And that's when critics of this law will point to those examples and say this is really just about control.
Boy, it'd be ironic if they're setting up this internet isolation as a way to address a possible hack against Russia's next election. But presumably there are other cyber attacks that they're worried about.
Well, no, they're pretty much spelled it out. It's the U.S. The U.S. Initially, it was cited that this could be anybody, but they've really drilled this down into the bill. This is absolutely pointing to the U.S. as the nemesis number one. They see that as the only country with the capability at this point to take them down.
Is this internet isolation law a strong indication that the U.S. and Russia are in a cyber Cold War?
I think so. I think clearly they see this as a necessary move on their part. I think it's twofold. I mean, on the one hand, it serves the point of preventing an attack by what they see as their primary adversary in the digital field, in the digital realm. At the same time, it's a way to control essentially possible movements within Russia, protest movements or expressions of dissent. You have to keep in mind also Vladimir Putin, obviously the longtime Russian president, he's always been really suspicious of the internet. He calls it a CIA project. And if you look at just the general trend on laws about the internet in Russia, they're all trending in this very repressive dimension. So recently, along with this digital sovereignty bill, we also have a bill that essentially prevents people from criticizing government authorities. This is under a fake news bill, as it's called here. So the idea of preventing, for example, disinformation online, sure, that sounds good. But in reality, the bill is really about preventing people from criticizing their own authorities.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Protests continue in Sudan as people there call for an end to military rule. Just last week, President Omar al-Bashir was toppled in a coup. A couple of days later, the coup leader himself stepped down. Today, Sudan is still in the hands of the military, now headed by Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The African Union is trying to change that. The AU says that unless civilian rule is established in 15 days, Sudan will be suspended from the bloc. So far, al-Burhan is refusing to budge. The BBC's Catherine Biarhunga is in Nairobi. She's following the African Union's intervention.
When a coup is staged, the African Union steps in quite strongly and says you will be suspended from the Union until you carry out elections or hand over to a civilian government. This has happened in places like Egypt, Mali, Guinea-Bissau, and so the African Union has a strong record of doing this. However, Sudan is quite complex. The African Union doesn't have as much leverage, but what we've seen over the last few days is some countries like Egypt, like Russia, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, recognizing the military rulers in Sudan. Western countries have been a bit more tentative. The United States Charge d'Affaires in Khartoum has met with the deputy leader. And so what we have is a push and pull between countries that are allied to Sudan, who would not want to see it fall apart. And if the Transitional Military Council can show itself to be able to stabilize the country, get the economy working again, then there will be other countries outside of the African Union who would be willing to work with the military leaders in Sudan.
I'm wondering if the African Union came up with its demand too quick. I mean, the coup leaders in Sudan over the weekend did say they would be in power for 2 years. Doesn't that suggest they intend to transition from the old regime?
What the African Union said in its first statement was that they didn't feel the military takeover was in line with the wishes of the people of Sudan. And we have seen protests continue, thousands of people go out on the streets saying that they do not want a military leadership, they want a civilian government. And because of these established rules within the African Union, they had to follow procedure and warn the military leaders in Sudan that they will suspend them if they do not hand over to a civilian government. And be clear, there are thousands of people in Sudan who would support this move, who would say, we want an interim civilian government that would be able to organize elections. They do not trust the military rulers, some of whom have been accused of war crimes. And so they would want to see them completely removed from power.
If Sudan were to be suspended from the African Union, wouldn't the civilian protesters in Sudan lose one of their best covers, the unity of the rest of the entire continent?
The reason why being suspended from the African Union is quite key is that you lose legitimacy as a government, as a military council. You're not able to go to summits. You're not able to take part in international diplomacy. The other key problem could be in terms of economy, access to funding, whether from the African Union, the African Development Bank, the IMF and the World Bank. At this crucial point where The economy is suffering. Sudanese are struggling to find basic resources like food, fuel, electricity. Not being able to kickstart your economy could have an impact. But we've just heard from the State Department in the United States. They said if the leadership in Sudan shows itself to be able to put in place some democratic processes, they show themselves to be able to fight terrorism or elements of terrorism in Sudan, they will look at removing them from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Now, that would open up a whole world of funding, which would be very key for the economy in Sudan.
The BBC's Catherine Biarahunga joining us from Nairobi to discuss the latest news from Sudan. Thanks very much, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
Let's say you're a historian who spent years researching one man's life, and you read about this one book that man compiled, and you just have to get your hands on it. Why? That book was intended to be a catalog of all printed knowledge in the world. But this book, it's been lost for hundreds of years. You assume it's been destroyed, but then it turns up. Imagine what that would feel like. Okay, that's basically what happened to Edward Wilson Lee 3 weeks ago. Wilson Lee is a professor at Cambridge University in the UK, and the book is Libro de los Epítomes from the 16th century.
This is part of a wider, extraordinary story about Hernando Colón. He was the illegitimate son of Christopher Columbus. And because he was illegitimate, he felt like he needed to prove himself his father's worthy heir in spirit if he wasn't legally his father's heir. So as a kind of counterpart to his father's project to circumnavigate the world, sail west and return from the east, Hernando decided to build a universal library which would have every book in the world in it, with every book in every language on every subject. And this was right at the dawn of the era of print. So the number of books was rising exponentially. And he realized that the idea of this library was a wonderful one, but of course it might become unmanageable if he was just collecting the books and not finding a way to organize and distill them. So he paid an army of readers to basically read every book in the library and to distill it down to a short summary so that all of this knowledge could be put at the disposal of a single person. And it's this book, the Libro de los Epítomes, that is described by his last librarian in a document at the end of Hernando's life, but then disappears and isn't really heard of basically for 500 years because it's been sitting for at least 350 of those years in Scandinavia, where it was unrecognized. And an academic from Canada thought it might have something to do with Hernando's library. And as I have been working on this biography of Hernando and I'm working on an account of the library with my colleague from Spain, José María Pérez Fernández, was in the right position to be able to fly over to Copenhagen very excitedly and verify that this is indeed a key missing piece of Hernando's great library project.
So you've laid out a lot of history there, Edward, but at the heart of what you've just said is a really wacky idea, a giant book of the world's books. So what can you tell us about Hernando Colón and his life? Because, I mean, for somebody to come up with this idea, I mean, that's wild.
Yeah, so he had this obsessive compulsive desire to list things. So he not only compiled this most enormous library of his day, this universal library, he had the largest collection of printed images in the world. He had the largest collection of printed music in the world. He started a dictionary, which only got to the letter B, but it's 1,432 pages by the time he gets to that point. And very few people, almost no one other than Hernando, really saw how print was going to change the world. Book collectors at the time collected largely manuscripts. They wanted the oldest manuscripts of Plato and Cicero and things like that. But Hernando recognized that how print was going to change the world was not by making this elite ancient material available, but by making cheap and very current material available. You know, early news sheets and weather forecasts and the earliest kind of proto novels. And Hernando collected this material, and this is really what's so exciting and important about his library.
I'm speaking with Edward Wilson Lee, a professor at Cambridge University, about the Libro de los Epítomes. So what was Hernando's relationship like with his dad, Christopher Columbus?
So they had this extraordinary relationship built in part on the fact that Hernando went on Columbus's last voyage, his fourth and last voyage to the New World. And it was an utter disaster. At the end of it, the two of them spent a year living together on a shipwreck off northern Jamaica. Really can never get to know someone quite as well as spending a year living on a shipwreck with them. He knew his father in this incredibly intimate way, and he idolized his father. When he came to write the biography of his father, which was a defense of his father, we forget that in the decades after Columbus's death, his reputation was very much in the balance, not for the reasons it is nowadays. People didn't think that this obscure Genoese person should really be given the credit for changing the world in the way he did. Columbus's fame starts to slip away, and it's really Hernando who writes his father's story. The story of a visionary who beat the odds and saw his vision through. And that's the story of Columbus that the Romantics idolized, that became this great symbol of achievement for later history. And the true story of Columbus is slightly buried in all of that.
I mean, you spoke of the obsessive kind of need to make lists and compile things by Hernando, but was his undertaking also a deliberate contradiction of how his father saw the world, a place to conquer, and he kind of saw it more holistically?
Oh, no. I mean, I think it's also true that Hernando's desire to compile a universal library was as a tool of great power. He also wanted to put this library at the service of Spain's universal empire. The idea was that a universal empire would require a central nervous system. This library would be the central nervous system. With Google or Facebook or something nowadays, if you have all of the information in the world and ways of distilling it and sorting it and making it usable, that confers enormous power upon you.
What happened to Hernando Colón's library after he died?
As you know, the story often goes, he left the library to a nephew who unfortunately was also a wastrel and who was notable largely for being imprisoned in North Africa for bigamy, and who didn't care about the books. So the books bounced around. They spent a time in a monastery, and then they ended up in Seville Cathedral, where, again, because people didn't really recognize the worth of what Hernando had done, a lot of people saw these pamphlets that he had collected as just trash. It was locked away in an attic room where for hundreds of years its importance was unrecognized. And during that time, theft and damage from weather and various other things reduced it to about a quarter of its original size. And there is still that quarter in Seville, but the rest of it we only know through these catalogues.
You authenticated this Libro de los Epítomes, this giant volume. Were you able to pick it up? I mean, what did it feel like?
Yes, it is a monster of a thing. It's about almost a foot thick. It's 2,000 pages long. So they didn't manage to summarize all the books in the library. The library at Hernando's desk was 15,000 to 20,000 volumes, and they'd only summarized 3,500 of them. And this manuscript is not complete. So there's a little over 2,000 books summarized in this. But very excitingly, many of these books will probably not survive anywhere else in the world in any other form. So, you know, this is a kind of catalogue of lost books in a really kind of exciting way. But it is a gorgeous thing. So as a scholar of early modern books and a lover of old books, it's really one of the most exciting things I've ever come across.
Edward Wilson Lee is a professor at Cambridge University. He's been telling us about the Libro de los Epítomes. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Ah, the old son trying to outdo the father narrative. That's a pretty good version of it, though. That's where we leave the proceedings today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.